Welcome to Talking Early Years with me, Juno Sullivan, and today I have a very special guest. So Helen Garnett, who I didn't meet till recently by one of those serendipitous moments where we found ourselves on a webinar together, is the author of a book that I absolutely love. And again, by accident, I spotted the book, I read the book, and I thought, this is right. This is like, this gets your heart. And so her book is about empathy in the early years. And when we met on the webinar and then subsequently, I thought everybody has to hear what she has to say. So I'm welcoming Helen, and we're actually face to face today in London. And so I'm very delighted to have her here to talk about her book, what she does with a charity called Arc Pathway, and all the other things that she's interested in, and the fact that she has a wonderful history of being a teacher and a real warmth and affinity with small children.
Well, it's lovely to be here. Thank you for a very nice welcome. So, yes, I'm Helen Garnett, written Developing Empathy in the Early Years, which is a book for practitioners, by a practitioner, because that's what I am. And I've always had a real interest in littlies from, you know, tiny age. And but I think I had a kind of moment about 15 years ago when I went to a positive behaviour course, which even that title gives me the heebie-jeebies, because, yeah, I don't know, for all sorts of reasons. But the course leader in that course said every parent is doing their best, whatever it looks like. And for some reason, this was like a before moment and an after moment for me, because I thought, oh my goodness, of course they are, because I think we can be quite judgmental about people and just say, oh, she's always late, and oh, they're always this and always that. And suddenly I felt like, oh my goodness, all the years I've been looking at parents and perhaps being a bit grumpy because they turn up late or annoyed because they do this or the other. And I realized they're always doing their best. And then that kind of translated to children as well. Every child's doing their best and every teacher's doing their best. No one gets up in the morning and thinks, I'm going to do a really bad job today. And so it was a sort of really before and after moment. And from then I kind of got interested in what other people's stories look like and what's it like in their shoes. And I can remember this mother always coming late to pick up her child when I was teaching year one and thinking, being cross about it, thinking she's always late, I'm have to stay in the classroom for an extra half an hour every day. And then looking back and thinking, why was she late? You know, she was a GP, she was probably working really, really hard somewhere. So, and then serendipity, you talk about serendipity. I went to a lovely conference run by a friend of mine called Helen Lumgo, who's just a trooper, early years trooper. And you might have even been speaking there, June, it was about sort of 5 or 6 years ago. And Jessica Kingsley Publishers were out in the corridor. Oh. And I got talking to the editor there, who happened to be sort of manning the whatever. And we started talking about books and things and early years and what have you. And she said, could I send you a list of books that I think Jessica Kingsley might like to write, you know, get authors to write? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. So she did, and she sent me a list. At the bottom of the list, it said Developing Empathy. And my heart just went, wow, oh my goodness. And so I said, this is a great title. This is a great title, bottom. And she said, oh, would you just write a little bit about why you think it's a great title? I thought, well, am I doing your job or what? Anyway, so I did, sent it back. And then she sent me something else saying, could you write a bit more about this? I was thinking, okay, I'm really doing someone else's job. But never mind, I will. So I did. And then I got my lines completely crossed. She was actually asking me to write a book about developing empathy, which was great. And so, which I leapt at, of course. And then more serendipity, because there was more work with something called Think Equal, which is an amazing social enterprise by someone called Leslie Ugwin.
She's coming on our podcast quite
Yay!
Soon.
She's amazing. So she's amazing. And I did some work with them, and that's empathy through social, through stories, teaching empathy through stories. Amazing. So empathy, empathy, empathy from every angle was coming at me in another job and more empathy. And so it was a book that just needed to be written, because I think we're a very judgmental generation. I think social media made us pretty, you know,
really
judgmental.
Interesting observation, actually.
And,
yes.
Reality telly, you know, yeah. We look at that and go, oh, she's too this, he's too that. Mm-hmm. Don't like that. Twitter is just one long judgment, and which we can sort of, you know, ignore or read, but it can be quite disturbing sometimes. Mm. And I think that it's so easy to judge. It's kind of like the sort of stepping stone to a sort of new place, whereas empathy is a very slow, effortful route. And so I think the opposite of empathy is probably, I don't know, indifference, but another one, another sort of opposite to that is judgment. And so what I would love is to for teachers and parents and children to learn to be in someone else's footsteps and to sort of be in their shoes and understand more, because I really think the world opens up then, becomes something completely different.
It's really interesting that your observation about us now being quite judgmental and the impact of social media. How do you think that then, you know, translates into the classroom, so to speak? How do you think we develop that in the way we respond to children? Are that we even notice that when we respond to children?
What, in the sort of judgment way?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's so easy to do, because it becomes a bit of a mindset, really. This is how I react to people, this is how I respond to people. I think some settings are amazing and there isn't any of that. But others that I've been into, you notice it, you know, oh, this child, oh, it's driving me mad. That mother, oh, she's just awful. That kind of thing. It's a sort of almost a sickness in that place. And when we learn not to do that, when we think parents are doing the very best they can do, children are doing the very, very best they can do, then we can support them in that. I think it's a, you know, I remember there was a child in one of my settings who people didn't like. Teachers were very, they just said, there's something about him, I just don't like him. And it made me really sad. And I could see what they meant, because he was a sort of, if you're going to say it, a difficult child. Now, what does that even mean? It doesn't mean he's unlikable. So it's sort of having that mindset, I'm not going to judge, I'm going to empathise. And just I'm going to do that first. I think sort of can change cultures, you know, and just creating this culture of empathy.
It kind of fits with that Carol Dweck, you know, and
yes.
She talks a lot about mindsets. And
yes.
We've been reviewing her work recently in light of change, you know, the COVID change, the changes we have to make. And I think it's a very well reference book as well, in that it does kind of get you thinking differently.
Mm.
We have a whole thing here about change, which is called ADKAR, which is a mantra from a marketing company. I should know, but it's a very simple way of looking at it. But A stands for a kind of an appreciation, a willingness, and an awareness of why you need to have the change. But the D is the magic thing, because the D is the desire.
Ooh,
so
lovely.
How do you think that, you know, to get people to desire change? You know, I think, isn't it Darwin who said, you know, those of us who don't change are the ones that are left behind.
Mm.
But, and I can't remember, somebody else said, people don't like change even when it's good for them.
Yeah.
But if you think about that sort of empathetic mindset, how do you, you know, sort of shift into that?
I think it's quite catching. So if you've got one member of staff who has that mindset and you know, somebody who's empathetic is so delightful to be with. They're kind, they're aware, they listen, they think, they suggest things, they sort of see beyond what's sort of there. They can be quite annoying sometimes.
Yeah.
but they're not saintly. They're just really, really aware. Challenging, all those things. And I think if you've got one person, just one person, that becomes it's very contagious.
So it's contagious, but can we teach it?
Well, definitely. We can develop it.
Go on.
So empathy, you know, we're all built for empathy. We're all built for kindness. We've been wired that way.
That's a really positive start.
Yeah, which is great, isn't
wired
it?
Wired for kindness.
Yeah, we are wired for kindness.
Do you think we could wire our politicians for kindness?
Oh, wouldn't that be great? I don't know how we can do that. I don't know. I think they've just got their wirings a bit crossed, didn't they?
I think that when you hear that expression, now I can now see it live.
So annoying, isn't it, when just people just don't display it. But yeah, we are wired for kindness, which is amazing. So, you know, our brains love it when we're touched lovingly, when people smile at us, when, you know, all of that. And likewise, that sort of reciprocal thing, brains fire up, we're wired for it. And so, and we're rewarded for it, you know, all that dopamine and oxytocin and all of that all fire away when we're kind and when people show us kindness. And so I think that when we're wired for it, and you know, how do we? Well, I spent a whole book on it, but there's so many ways of developing empathy. So it's what's your language like in your setting? You know, the sort of positive language, and that, I mean body language as well as, you know, communicating orally. The sort of power of positive. You know, when people see the word no, it releases all these stress hormones. So when people see the word yes, I'm assuming it's the opposite way around. So language, positive language, your pedagogy, you know, what is your pedagogy? Because you can just put empathy right in the heart of it. And that's, it's really, I mean, we could talk a whole thing, couldn't we, on pedagogy?
Oh, yes.
But, and I love your sofa pedagogy, by the way. I keep bringing up your sofa pedagogy. Well, that's a sort of kindness thing, isn't it? And then conflict resolution, self-regulation, co-regulation, and just this sort of full understanding, knowing what empathy is, actually, because it's not just being kind and a bit compassionate and understanding people and putting yourself in someone's shoes. It's understanding that someone's feeling something, bothering to find out what that is, working out, well, what can I do? What's my place in this? And then doing that. So it's a massively long sort of process.
So in a way, it is an essential component of what we call inclusion.
Yes, it is.
But yet, interestingly, I think if you ask people to talk about inclusion, I rarely hear them use the word empathy.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone talk about empathy when they've been talking about inclusion.
No, but it's kind of light bulb, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
That actually, if you are to understand what inclusion looks like, you need to step in someone's shoes.
Mm.
That surely is the way to start the process. But I think people think jump straight into policies, procedures, ways of bringing people in. But bringing people in and having people from every colour, class, background, age, whatever, or ability, isn't really inclusion, is it? If the culture in the organisation or in the setting isn't empathetic.
I agree. I wish they didn't even have the word inclusion, because it's obvious. I mean, that should be happening anyway.
Yeah.
Why is it a word even? So you're right. Empathy is everything, because when we understand other people, it's not just their viewpoints, it's just their heart.
Yeah.
You know, I often think that if we are wholehearted and single-minded, if everybody was that, wholehearted and single-minded and a bit effortful about things, we'd have a completely different world. But people are so distracted and so just sort of
discombobulated a lot of the time.
Discombobulated, yeah. We perhaps don't have time or the energy or the effort, or I don't know what it is.
Because you are right, actually, because people often say, hate to live in London, you know, everyone's so busy and so aggressive and so unpleasant. But actually, that's not the case at all. When you smile, someone will smile back at you. Or when you wait for someone, or you step, or you hold a door, people are grateful, and maybe more grateful because maybe they think also this isn't something that somebody in London would do. Or if you help a tourist or whatever, there's a great kind of engagement and a warmth that builds up. So do you not think, therefore, then, that the language we're operating in, this language of, I often think quite deficit in that kind of woe but me, mental health, well-being. Now, I'm not suggesting that there isn't an issue here, but, you know, when it's always seen like a deficit.
Yeah.
I remember in lockdown, all I heard was like, it was this and it was failing and it was terrible and the world's going to come to an end. And I was seeing the children at 3 o'clock every day because we had a hubs, you know, during that period. And I kept seeing their positive, lovely faces and their joyful responses and their fun and their engagement. And I thought to myself, how can this narrative dominate when we are responsible for these future citizens? Mm. And they're completely forgotten about, of course, naturally enough, in the press and the likes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I just, so it was that tipped me into writing about sustainability and really, really deepening my knowledge about it, because I was just thinking, no, we have this future. But do you not sometimes think that those kind of, it's almost, people almost get off on some of this kind of negative narrative, and it actually makes people feel bad?
Yes.
And it actually devalues the complexity and the importance of things like well-being and health.
Yeah, I think we've got into a really negative mindset in this country, maybe globally, I don't know. And it's not really necessary. And going back to your thing about going to London, you know, I think two people can go to London in exactly the same street, exactly the same place, exactly the same people, and have two very different experiences. One very positive and one very negative. And I think I suspect you are as well. I'm a positive person. So if I go into a lovely cafe, I'm going to be smiling and chatting to people and come out thinking, oh, they're all so nice. Whereas someone else might go in and the opposite thing. So it does depend on your personality and your mindset and how you're feeling. And I do feel there is a narrative that is very, very negative and very, very unnecessary. Yes, I acknowledge that people have had a really difficult time.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Absolutely. And I acknowledge that there is a lot of mental health.
Agreed.
Issues going on.
We're seeing it all over the place.
We have majorly exaggerated it in places where it isn't. We've made it up where it isn't. And like, those lovely faces looking up at you at the 3 o'clock on the afternoon, you know, that's beautiful. That's so lovely. And those children at that moment are having a lovely time. And, all children aren't having an awful time all the time. It's just mad. It's gone mad.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad you're saying that, because I was beginning to think, is it just me getting old and grumpy, or is it real? Because there's no benefit to it.
No.
I just spent this morning visiting two leaf nurseries, you know, joyful children, smiley, happy staff, please. And one of them was saying to me, you know, I was so nervous coming back because it was one of the nurseries we closed, and I was so nervous coming back because I've kind of got not used to hugging people anymore. And I'm a hugger, you know, she said, I'm a hugger. Mm. And when the staff, you know, saw me for the first time, they said, can I give you a hug? And I said, no, not yet. I'm not ready for it. And then she said, and then this delightful child came running up to me with her arms wide open. And she said, I immediately bent down and picked her up.
Mm.
And that broke it for me. It sort of broke it. I think there's a joy and there's a glory about working with children that nobody understands unless they're in that world.
Absolutely.
In terms of that emotional connection, that love and, you know, development that comes. But there's also a, sometimes I think slightly, I don't know, toxic seems a wrong word, but a kind of unhappiness, a kind of misery that comes down, often, like you say, through the social media chat. And one thing that seems to have got everybody going was regulation, self-regulation, co-regulation, the world of regulation, so to speak. Can you walk us through your thoughts on that? Because to me, the regulation was about metacognition, it was about empathy, it was about understanding how people learn, finding your way, walking alongside people in that pedagogical partnership. I never quite understood why it made so many people so angry.
I don't understand it either, June. I don't. I think it's really simple, isn't it? The concept of self-regulation, co-regulation, regulation. Children learn when they're regulated. In other words, when they're calm, when they're not hungry, or they're not tired, and when they just feel absolutely normal. And that learning, potential for learning, just is massive then. And children can't learn when they're dysregulated, unregulated, because it's, you know, the brain just won't allow them to. It's too busy surviving, or it's too busy being sort of, you know, really anxious to learn. And so all it is walking alongside children. Regulation, all it is walking alongside children and supporting them to learn at the most optimal level that they can through love and empathy and kindness and excitement and, you know, wonderful resources or no resources at all. You still have a fabulous time and no resources.
Absolutely.
And the sort of co-regulation bit. I mean, I can co-regulate you and you can co-regulate me. If I'd come in here feeling really nervous, you could have calmed me down. But that, you know, it's regulation. But it's not just about calming down. I think we get it so confused with behaviour. So when I said I went on that positive behaviour course, mm-hmm. I didn't like the title. It's because behaviour is looked on as the thing we've got to correct and then the children will learn, rather than that children have got to be regulated. You know, behaviour is a communication for all these things that are going on. If a child's got sensory processing issues and goes into a very loud, big, echoey room, they're not going to be able to learn. Mm-hmm. And so we need to understand that child's sensory needs and meet them. And that's called regulation. And another child might come in and they've had a terrible time at home. Maybe their pet's died or something awful's happened. They're not going to be able to learn. So find out and support them and regulate them. And then they'll be able to learn. So that's all it is, isn't it?
Well, I think it's that. And it's also about how we then support the children to find their own ways inside, their own sort of...
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, their own sort of cognitive kind of cues and, yes. And methods and eventually recognise it and eventually maybe articulate it. So,
exactly.
You know, I learn better if I'm outside. I need to calm down right now. Right now, my amygdala has been hijacked by
yes.
anxiety. So I need to walk around the block or I need to have... But all of those things, and ultimately the children become the adults who then understand how to regulate their own approaches to how they learn and that. But I think there's been confusion with the language. I think that the word itself has confused people. Mm. And in doing that, there's been this big anxiety, which is like regulation is about sitting still.
Oh, no.
And I think that's why people got angry about it. But in that anger, it didn't then... convert or translate that anger into, I would say, useful, helpful translation that would be useful for a practitioner. And
yeah.
I think what happens then is everyone avoids talking about it because they're scared in case they say the wrong thing
yes.
or they can't do it.
Yes.
But I don't think in all of this conversation, empathy was particularly used. I think it was seen as an entirely negative process. It was like regulation is about being good,
yes,
about listening
yes.
well,
yes,
about
yes
behaving
mm.
and so as a consequence what really regulation is, which
yeah.
is a much more,
it's so much more, isn't
metacognition
it? Yeah.
cognitive kind of process,
absolutely,
that actually that got lost
yeah.
that got lost in the whole process. How do you think we might kind of in a way reclaim these kind of particularly co-regulation, because I think that's
yeah.
the most significant of all of that,
yeah,
pedagogically we're leading to learn, we're walking alongside
mm.
people, so co-regulation feels like a useful way of describing
yes.
the process.
I think I love the term co-regulation. There was a little boy, I won't say his name, many years ago, who was in our nursery, and he was very, very troubled. His there was just all sorts of problems with the family. You know, people were in prison and lots of sort of step brothers and sisters all over the place and fathers and mothers, and he was very, very troubled, and he came to us. He was I think, you know, in the last year before he went to reception, and we just didn't know what to do, and people were, it was one of those things you thought, oh gosh, we can't have him leave us because we failed him, but it felt like that. And then so we went all in to find out exactly what had happened. We did home visits, lots of them, and because that really helped hugely. And so we could find out, you know, what it was like at home. We did all sorts of things at the setting. But what we wanted to do was to let him find a way of being able to remove himself from this high anxiety into a different place of calm. That was our aim, because we knew everything else would follow. And it was amazing, June. It was amazing, because this little boy, over not very long, didn't take too long at all, about 2 or 3 months. So we would say to him, you know, what are you feeling? What's happening? Because he was able to say what was happening and what he was feeling. And he's like, I'm so hot! I just so hot! And, you know, you could just see him shaking with rage. And so we'd just be with him. Someone would be with him. He would sort of slowly calm down. You could feel his body just relaxing. And then we'd say, right, what do you want to do now? Do you want to go outside? Or do you want to stay outside? You know, let me come with you, blah, blah, blah. And we just carried on doing this for a while, just helping him see what was going on in his head, why he was feeling like that, and what we could do next, and how that would help him. And then saying afterwards, look what you did. Look what you did. You managed to calm down. That was amazing. With us, blah, 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 blah. And within about, 2 or 3 months, he was a different boy. And I'm absolutely convinced that if we hadn't caught it that early, it would have been big trouble for him.
Right.
Troubled teenager, you know, awful.
Just full of anger and not knowing what to do with it.
Not knowing what to do with it. So isn't it the most amazing privilege that we as practitioners can help children like that?
Put like that, actually, it's quite significant.
Yeah.
So before you go, I guess, I would just... I want you to sort of shout out for the power of empathy. And if there were three things that you would see, you know, or would like to see in any setting that you feel would build a kind of empathetic environment, what would they be?
I think the first one is that you look at your staff and appeal to the people who clearly have empathy already. And go and talk to them about what empathy is and how we can place it deep, deep, deep in our pedagogy. It sounds such an obvious thing to do, but it can become something that's just on the side and it has to be right in the middle. You know, you have to have roots of empathy and they have to grow. And then I would say that whatever that person said in that course, everyone's doing their best to really have the staff look at, do I judge or do I empathise, and actually ask it straight out and have talks about that. Because when people suddenly realise, yeah, I am judging and it's not okay, then that changes something within that setting, becomes a completely different thing. And I think then lastly, it's just every single adult loving those children, loving those parents, and being prepared to be effortful and being empathetic themselves, which it is extraordinary the difference it makes when people realise how powerful empathy is. It's not just some silly word that we use on Empathy Day. It's a way of life. And when we start doing it ourselves, it's amazing, life-changing.
Thank you very much, Helen, for coming in and talking to us about empathy. And I look forward to reading your next book on deeper and more empathy.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. It's been lovely being with you. Thank you.
So look out for the next podcast, which will be coming down the line pretty soon, as we like to issue them every month just to give you some time to take it all in and get cross and get a cup of tea and enjoy. Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. If you like what you heard, please share it or check us out on our website, leaf.org.uk.